than to be a black girl who looks white, or any other kind of black girl for that matter. Her signature move is to grip the pole with both hands, arch her back, and slide lower until her long hair brushes the stage while she frantically rocks her pelvis up and down. She hates the pole, how it is always warm and sticky to the touch, coated in human oils, and also how, when she's leaning back or wrapping her leg around the pole or hanging upside down while shaking her tits, she's not doing anything special. Not really. Sarah hates the smell of ones and fives, but can live with the stink of bigger bills. She tans 3 days a week, naked, so there are no lines. She sees an esthetician for full body waxing once or twice a month, enhances her hairstyle with blonde extensions, replaced every 2 months. She works out for 2 hours a day, 7 days a week, eats 1,400 calories a day. It is an exhausting regimen, but an occupational hazard. She attends Johns Hopkins during the week, where tuition costs almost $40,000, and financial aid covers only two-thirds of that cost. Sarah pays for the rest out of her own pocket. She has 1 year remaining before she graduates with degrees in international studies and romance languages, plus coursework in Arabic. It is 2004. She plans on working for the CIA because she has become quite efficient at passing. At first, Sarah was a mess of a stripper. She couldn't dance. She didn't like being watched. She didn't want to be touched. She hated the pretense of the gowns that quickly hit the floor when she was on stage or giving a lap dance. She hated the improbable heels and the G-string panties riding up her ass, and the way she stank of smoke after a long night, and how she always had to look over her shoulder as she walked to her car at the end of a shift. Still, she didn't relish wearing a polyester uniform and visor cap either, and she couldn't live on what those jobs paid. Sarah took Candy's advice and started watching BET for the necessary instruction. In the privacy of her apartment in Towson, she tried to clap her ass and bounce and shake her body like the girls in the videos, and the girls she grew up with in West Baltimore, who moved so fast and with such elegant precision. William Livingston III mostly lives to watch Sierra dance to Lil Jon's Get Low, because the song is still very popular in such establishments. He's willing to pay for the privilege of watching Sierra dance. He likes Sierra's routine, how she points to the window, to the wall, and mimics the sweat dripping down her proverbial balls. He visits her at the club 3 times a week, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. He stays for 2 hours. He tips her anywhere between $100 and $500. After she dances to Get Low, Sierra gives him a lap dance, shimmying out of her skimpy gown, draping it over William's shoulder. She straddles his lap and sexily removes her bra, wrapping it around his balding head, and then looping it around his neck like a leash. She squeezes her breasts together, flicks her tongue across her nipples, feels William's cock stiffen between the spread of her thighs. She leans into his chest, but pulls away before she gets too close. The more money he slides beneath the narrow waistband of her G-string, the lower and harder she grinds her hips. If Sierra looks down and sees a crown of bills wrapping her waist, she'll let William hold her ass, even though he always leaves little bruises. He propositions Sierra regularly. He wants to fuck her in a restaurant bathroom. He wants to take her to a fine hotel and sip champagne from her body, feed her cold grapes. He wants to tongue her navel and shower her with bling and ride her doggy style. William hasn't yet figured out her price. He was making progress toward being able to see Sierra outside the club. She didn't scowl as much when she saw him, until one day he said, "I want to fuck you filthy because my wife is a goddamn prude." Sierra pushed William away, said, "I can't believe what you just said." Her scowl returned, seemed deeper even. So he started coming to the club 4 nights a week, told his wife he found a new bridge group. Ciara tries to leave Sarah at home, but often fails. She is racked with guilt when she thinks about all the married men who leer from the tip rail and sit in the darkened booths with their legs wide open, lamenting all the dirty things their wives won't do. Sarah finds such conversations impolite, and having seen so much, too much of these men, she bears not a small amount of sympathy for their women. After her shift, Sarah goes to the diner a few doors down from the club, her face scrubbed clean. She wears a t-shirt and jeans, her hair swept up in a neat ponytail. She sits at an empty table and carefully smooths out the bills she's accumulated, separating them into piles by denomination. Sometimes a waiter named Alvarez will sit with her, counting out his own tips. She's desperately in love with Alvarez because he doesn't ask her out, because his hands are gentle and clean, because he doesn't say anything unkind about her profession, even though he smells it on her. He keeps her coffee fresh and brings her big salads with dressing on the side, then gives her foil-wrapped handy wipes to clean her hands with after she's done calculating her worth for that night. Alvarez loves Sarah with equal fervor, but he's illegal, sin papeles, and worries what would happen if one thing led to another. Alvarez is a worrier. When he was a baby in Honduras, his mother would find her beautiful boy in his crib, not crying but fretting, chewing on the slender wisps of his baby fingernails. On nights when he's too tired or foolish to worry, he'll sit on the same side of the booth as Sarah and hold her hand. He'll whisper to her in Spanish. Sometimes he'll sing his favorite song, Volver, by Estrella Morente. As Alvarez sings, he taps the table in a steady beat, and Sarah sways from side to side, and sometimes she sings along too. He loves the song because he loves the name Estrella, which means star. He has named their imaginary daughter Estrella. When he walks Sarah to her car, he'll point up to the night sky and say, Mira las estrellas. And Sarah will look up, and her heart will beat fiercely, tenderly. William loves black women. But he's wealthy, and his wealth has history. He doesn't have what it takes to go there. Men like him can't go there. His father, William Livingston II, once told him, the Livingstons had long been touched by a spot of jungle fever, but that men of their class did not give in to such petty demands. As William and his father watch their black housekeepers in their tight, gray and white uniforms, bending over to dust and arrange the objects in their lives, father and son would ogle and grin. William II would grab William III by the shoulder and say, You can look, boy, but you cannot touch. The family can't afford the scandal. William sublimates his desires by listening to rap music. When the urge becomes unbearable, when his tongue is wet with the desire to taste a black woman's skin, he drives slowly through West Baltimore, openly staring at the young black girls in apple-bottoms jeans, with their hair gelled to their scalps and their bouncing hoop earrings, their brightly painted lips. He stares until they flash him dirty looks and call him a dirty old man or worse. In those moments when these girls are looking right at him with their righteous anger, his cock swells and strains against his fine wool slacks. He whispers, Look, but don't touch, until his mouth is dry and full. He lives in Guilford with his wife and teenage son, in an all but stately brick mansion left to him by his father, along with a significant trust fund. When William first brought his wife Estelle, a pale blonde sliver of Connecticut, she clutched the pearls around her neck and said, It's like we're nowhere near Baltimore. Thank goodness for that. She had heard things about Baltimore all the way up in Greenwich. Her friends told her moving to Baltimore would be like moving to the jungle. Estelle is unaware of William's penchant for the blackberry, though she finds his taste in music curious. At night, before bed, he stands in his media room between his state-of-the-art speakers, blasting DMX and Method Man and Soulja Boy. He watches rap videos, enjoying the lurid images of televised vixens sliding down poles and crawling across floors, and allowing rappers to swipe credit cards between their ample ass cheeks. He indulges in the fantasy of fucking one of these ebony women right there, between the speakers, the bass so heavy it presses down on them like a holy spirit. Carmen, a young black woman, is William and Estelle's housekeeper. She lives in the maid's quarters over the garage. She has dark mahogany skin, full lips, big breasts, narrow waist, a perfect black ass. When William described the young woman to his friends at the country club, he said, "She has the kind of ass they carry babies on back in Africa." And then laughed and enjoyed a sip of brandy. Carmen speaks softly with a southern lilt. She smells like cocoa butter. When she showed up at the Livingston manse, she was hired on the spot. William promptly installed a series of surveillance cameras and microphones throughout her apartment that recorded to a hard drive he could access anywhere. He used to think his wealth was a burden, but quickly realized what he could get away with. William rents office space, so he has a reason to leave the house. Other than monitoring his investments online, he doesn't work. He watches video of Carmen sleeping and showering, talking to her mother in South Carolina, watching TV, reading. He almost fucked the maid once. It was late at night, and he went to her room, his bathrobe cinched tightly around his waist. When Carmen answered her door, it was clear he had woken her up. She crossed her arms across her chest, shifted, nervously. William gripped her shoulders, breathing heavily through his nose. "I own everything in this house," he said, then laughed the same laugh he laughed at his father's deathbed when he realized just how wealthy he was about to become. Carmen wore only a thin white nightgown with thin straps and flowers embroidered along the neckline. He reached between her thighs and looked right in her eyes. Carmen didn't look away. She grabbed hold of his wrist, pushed it away. She said, "I need this job." William smiled, looked to the floor. Carmen never spoke much, but she was a smart girl. When she slowly sank to her knees, William placed a meaty hand on the top of her head, traced her hairline with his thumb.
"Are you familiar with that twist of song? Wetter."
He didn't wait for an answer.
"In that song, the girl says she needs a daddy. Do you need a daddy, Carmen?"
Carmen loosened the belt holding his bathrobe closed, sighed, leaned forward. As his housekeeper gave him a blowjob, William Livingston III reassured himself that this wasn't the same as fucking a black girl. He was getting his dick wet, something men of his ilk had been doing for more than 100 years. He closed his eyes, tightened his grip on Carmen's bobbing head, and imagined fucking her on a beach in Ibiza or over his desk in his office. Just before he came, he ordered her to remove her nightgown. She acquiesced. He ejaculated on her breasts, ordered her to rub him into her skin. He left just as quickly as he came, then watched the video of Carmen scrubbing herself clean from the quiet comfort of his study. He never bothered her again. He had gotten what he wanted. When he's not watching his housekeeper, William listens to his music and repeats the lyrics about Skeeting and Becky's and backing that ass up and living the gangsta life. His office has a small closet where he keeps urban clothing he sends his assistant to West Baltimore to purchase. Sean John jeans and Fat Farm hoodies and Timberland boots. His understanding of what the kids are wearing is dated. Sometimes he poses in front of the full-length mirror, grabbing handful of denim-clad crotch and sets his chin to the side and tries to recreate gang signs with his fingers. After a busy day of wool gathering, William retires to the country club for dinner with his wife and son, or attends a charity gala, or goes to visit Sierra, the white girl with a black girl's ass. William is becoming more possessive, getting angry if he sees her laughing with or dancing for other customers. His hands are greedier and grabbier than ever. Sierra doesn't like it, doesn't like how he interrogates her about the lap dance she was giving to two college guys when he entered the club. She tells him his jealousy bores her. He frowns. A yin-yang twins song is pounding out of the speakers, the whisper song. It is one of William's favorite songs. She frowns. You are only paying for my time when you're in here, William. I thought you knew that. He licks his lips, tries to grab her breasts before settling on holding her ass, enjoying how the ample flesh peeks into the spaces between his fingers. Sierra allows the affection because there is a wreath of at least $300 around her waist.
I'd prefer to buy all your time. Why don't you become my private dancer?
Sierra laughs. Like the song. William's cock throbs. He loves Tina Turner. Those legs, that voice, those lips. He grins.
Exactly like the song.
Sierra turns so her ass is facing William. She wiggles coquettishly, so her cheeks bounce and jiggle in his face. She turns to look at him over her shoulder, tossing her long hair to the side. She licks her lips, slowly. William groans, slides lower in his seat, pulls Sierra against him so they are touching. He closes his eyes and thinks about West Baltimore girls. He listens to the lyrics. He believes in the lyrics. He wants a bitch to see his dick. He wants to beat that pussy up. He comes in his pants, a damp stain slowly inching toward his inseam. When Sierra tries to stand, he holds her tight. She tries to pry his fingers loose, but he is stronger. She glares at the bouncer watching the scene, throws her hands up. The bouncer shrugs, continues to watch. William always tips generously, so the bouncer won't intervene when William breaks club rules, which he does regularly. Sierra gives the bouncer the finger, her slow, angry burn spreading. After work, Sarah is in a foul mood. She goes to the diner and stands near the entrance, pacing back and forth. Alvarez is refilling salt and pepper shakers. He looks up and smiles, then frowns as he observes her rigid posture, the rage rolling off her in waves. He wipes his hands on his apron, tells his boss he has to leave early. Alvarez drives Sarah home in her car. He asks her what's wrong, but she is silent. Neither song nor stars will console her. At her apartment, Alvarez follows her inside and sits nervously on her couch. Sarah takes a picture from a bookshelf against one wall and hands it to Alvarez. She points to a tall, attractive woman with caramel skin and a sad smile. She sits. "That's my mother," she says. Alvarez's eyes widen, but he inches closer to Sarah. He says,
"Tu madre es bonita. Eres mi negra blanca."
He removes his apron, rolls up his sleeves, and runs a bath for Sarah. She disrobes in front of him, but does not worry. She steps into the warmth, one foot at a time, and sighs as she settles into the water. Alvarez reaches for the washcloth, neatly folded on a towel rack, and washes her gently, wiping away the human oils and the fingerprints and the stale cigarette smoke and the inappropriate behaviors. Sarah tells Alvarez about her horrible night at work. She tells him about men who can't take no for an answer, and other men who allow that sort of thing to happen. She is tired. So very tired.
Voy a matarlos, he mutters.
Sarah places her damp hand against his cheek. She says,
No es necesario.
It's an occupational hazard. Alvarez nods, but while Sarah lies in her tub, her skin clean and pink, her eyes closed, humming a strange little tune, he clenches his fists until his knuckles turn white. Then he kisses her forehead. William Livingston III sits in his BMW sedan outside Sierra's apartment. He is irate. He doesn't understand what the stripper is doing with a spick waiter when she could be with a man like him. He's listening to an angry DMX track, smoking a cheap, sweet cigar he stole from his son's room. He stares at himself in the rearview mirror and tries to bark fiercely like the rapper. He calls his wife Estelle, tells her he's going to be late. He can hear the gin in his wife's voice, knows it doesn't matter when he gets home. When the waiter leaves, William flicks the cigar butt onto the street, tries to smooth his hair over his bald spot. He's followed Sierra home several times now. He knocks on her door, traces the number 7. Sarah answers, wearing only a towel wrapped around her slender torso. She is laughing, but gasps when she recognizes William from the strip club. She tries to shut the door, but he wedges his foot against the door jamb. Sarah has often reviewed the worst-case scenarios requisite to her occupational hazards. But a customer showing up at her apartment north of the city never crossed her mind. She tries to close the door again, but this time William pushes past her and into the apartment. Sarah swallows the chill, winding itself around her spine. She thinks about the poli-sci paper she has to finish, the Sartre text she needs to read, the excerpt she has to translate, the appointment with her trainer, all this and more, before her next shift at the club. She thinks about Alvarez, who has named their daughter Estrella. She thinks about the food he had gone to pick up, and his sweet voice when he serenades her with Volver. She doesn't have time for this. She says, If you don't leave, I'm going to call the police, and if my boyfriend finds you here, he'll kill you. William is undeterred by her anger. He pulls off his tie and shoves Sarah to the floor. She hits her head against the coffee table as she falls. She finds her voice and screams so loudly the windows shake. But all William hears is a loud ringing. William's fist connects with Sarah's jaw, and a sharp pain sinks through the bone. Hot tears stream down her face, but she tries to hold it together. She tries to focus past William's pudgy body looming over her. She tries not to pass out, so she might bear witness. William kneels between Sarah's thighs. He uses a condom. He doesn't know where the stripper has been. He practices some of the lingo he has learned from years of listening to rap music.
I've wanted to get all up in that since the day I first saw you, Sierra. I love your fat ass.
Sarah moans and heaves, reaches for her cell phone on the coffee table. It is just beyond her reach. William flips her onto her stomach, and then he's inside her, breathing hotly into her ear, telling her that fucking her is just like fucking a black girl without having to fuck a black girl. He smacks her thigh and tells her to do as Lil Jon instructs and bounce, bounce, bounce that ass. Sarah focuses on her fury. She lets it bind her chest and her heart. She lets it cover her skin. She feels it in her blood. Her fury coats her mouth. He doesn't take long. With a final thrust, William groans into her ear. He presses his thin lips against her shoulder, a small token of affection. Sarah cringes. He lies on top of her, his sweaty weight pressing her farther into the floor. She tries to crawl away, but he is too heavy with liquor and food and fat. Eventually, he stands, admires Sarah's perfect ass again. He dresses and sits on her couch. He sets 10 crisp hundreds on her coffee table and says,
We could have done this the easy way, Sierra.
As he's about to take his leave, he looks down at the picture of Sarah's mother and pauses.
"This black woman looks just like you," he remarks.
Sarah reaches for her towel, shields herself. She steadies, inhales deeply. "You should leave now," she says, willing, her voice strong. William holds the picture up, pointing angrily.
"Why does this woman look like you?"
At the door, Alvarez hears the tension in Sarah's voice, pushes into the apartment. He eyes William, surveys the disarray, understands. He carefully puts his coat around Sarah's shoulders and stands in front of her. She rests her cheek against his back. She wraps one arm around his waist. She breathes. William's face is flushed through bright red as the picture falls from his hands. He backs out of Sarah's apartment, shaking his head. Alvarez moves to follow, but Sarah tightens her grip around his waist.
"We have to go to the police," he says.
But Sarah shakes her head.
"Occupational hazard,"
she whispers, forcing her lips into a semblance of a smile.
"I'm too tired."
She is beyond tired, really. She is empty, and she wants quiet. She wants quiet. Alvarez turns to look at her, at the bruises on her face, her arms. He worries about the bruises he can't see. He runs her another bath. She sits in the tub, her arms wrapped around her knees. Sarah is silent as he tries to wash her clean again. Later, they will lie in bed together, breathing softly, perfectly still. They won't touch, but Alvarez will keep watch. He will forego his worries and tell Sarah he loves her. He will remind her of Estrella, and in the darkness, she will finally smile. Sarah will want to tell Alvarez she loves him too, but won't. Not with her body still bearing the weight of William Livingston III. Instead, she'll reach across the short distance between them. Instead, she'll hold his hand and hope it's enough. William settles into the leather of his BMW and is instantly comforted by German engineering. He speeds away, but pulls over as soon as he puts distance between himself and the stripper's apartment. He leans out of his car and vomits, the acids burning his throat and mouth. There is whiskey in the glove compartment. He takes a long draw from the bottle, wipes his lips with the back of his hand. He pours some whiskey down his pants, tries to clean himself. His skin burns. Penance, he thinks, and absolution. As he drives, he ignores the sour coating on his lips, teeth, tongue. He is horrified. He is gleeful. He catches his reflection in the rearview mirror, ignores his father's disapproval staring back. William sits in his driveway, his forehead pressed against the leather-wrapped steering wheel for a long while. He tries to make peace with the fact that he has done something generations of Livingstons have had the discipline to avoid. He hears footsteps and looks up. William Livingston IV is whistling to himself as he walks back toward the main house from the garage. The older Livingston feels a huge weight being lifted as he watches his carefree boy. He gets out of the car and waves. The younger Livingston stops, smiles, waits for his father.
"It's a brave new world,"
William tells his son, clapping the boy's back with his greedy, grabby hands, before wrapping his arm around his son's shoulders and leading him inside. Baby Arm. I'm dating a guy who works as a merchandiser for a large department store, and one of his duties is designing window displays. He tells me this on our third date. We've already slept together twice. I'm not a hard sell. When he tells me about his job, we are at a sleazy bar drinking beer from the tap and frosted mugs. I tap my foot against his. I say, "I'm ready to go back to your place whenever you are." I'm anxious about all the getting-to-know-you conversations we're having. I've never enjoyed sitting through previews at movies. It always seems like such a waste of time. He tells me he dresses windows and has access to a storeroom full of mannequins and mannequin parts. I say, like in the movie Mannequin? And he doesn't get the reference. Disappointing. I explain about Andrew McCarthy and Meshach Taylor and Kim Cattrall frolicking in the middle of the night in a department store thanks to the magic of an ancient Egyptian necklace, all set to a synthesized 80s soundtrack. On our way to his place, we stop at a Red Box and rent the movie, and he loves it, and for the first time, I think the guy is not a complete tool. A couple of months later, he comes over to my apartment in the middle of the night because we've long abandoned any pretense of a mutual interest in anything but dirty sex. And he's holding a fiberglass baby arm, painted the color of flesh. He hands it to me and says, "I thought you might like this." And I take the baby arm and tell him if he's not careful, I will fall in love. And he says he would be fine with that. We take a bottle of wine and the baby arm to my bedroom, and I caress it while we kill the cheap bread. My mouth tastes fruity yet sour. Cheap. I don't mind. I'm quickly becoming enamored by the scraggly beard unevenly covering my lover's face, and his thin lips, and the sensation of him rubbing my back in lazy circles because he never knows how to make a move. Still doesn't understand. He only needs to push me on my back and tell me to spread my legs. I set the baby arm on the nightstand and provide him with a little seduction instruction. He follows directions well, so I lie beneath him and imagine a little more hair on his chest, a little more muscle wrapped around his bones. He grins, and I think about my best friend, Tate. Tate and I work together as publicists for a record label, and often lament how we are sacrificing our souls. We are not motivated to change our professional circumstances. We have to look pretty and make people believe in false idols and hold our liquor. For that, we are handsomely rewarded. We write off our gym memberships and depilatory regimens. Our offices are right next to each other, but we spend most of our time on the phone to each other, talking about our all-girl fight club. No boys allowed. Boys don't really know how to hurt girls. "Hey," he says, "are you with me?" I open my eyes and look up at him. A thin line of sweat beads along his hairline. I smile. I tell him to hate me more. He does. And a pleasant soreness begins spreading from between my thighs. And my head is slamming against the headboard. Now I'm with him. Later, I'm still awake because I'm not very good at sleeping. And I'm achy, so I'm feeling tender toward him. Instead of nudging him awake, telling him to go home, I watch him sleep. I hold the baby arm and marvel at how small and perfect it is, how each finger is exactly where it's supposed to be, slightly curled toward the wrist. I use the baby arm to trace my sort of boyfriend's arm. His name is Gus. Now that I'm sure of his name, I no longer call him "Hey You" or refer to him as the dude I'm nailing when talking to my friends. I hold the baby arm to my chest, and eventually I fall asleep. I really underestimated Gus. The next morning at my office, I call Tate and tell her how well Gus takes direction. She says, "Next time you fuck him, call me so I can listen to the two of you, and when you come, say my name." I tell her I will. That's what friends are for. We talk about the baby arm, how it almost articulates. I tell her how I lovingly cleaned it with a baby wipe and how I kissed each fingertip. She says, "I want a boy who'll bring me a baby arm." She asks me how I got so lucky, and I'm at a loss until I consider the sequence of events bringing Gus into my life. I explain I got so lucky because of a lifelong dedication to slutty and inappropriate behavior and my ability to drink tequila straight. She murmurs approvingly. I want to tell her it's fate, but she's hardcore and would probably laugh. I tell her I will ask Gus if he has any straight friends in merchandising. She says, "This calls for a celebration. We're having a fight club tonight." And she recites an address I don't recognize. How are we going to make a 13-year-old pop singer popular? I ask, briefly steering the conversation toward work. Tate is silent for a few moments. Finally, she says, old white ladies who perm their hair. We are very good at our jobs. When it's time for Fight Club, I show up at a sketchy strip mall, the kind that includes a depressing house of worship filled with posters of black Jesus and folding chairs, a chicken shack with two tables and a dirty counter promising a soupçon of salmonella, a retail emporium for strippers and their friends, and an urgent care clinic. The strip mall is the most perfect place in the world. Tate told me before I left work to go into the stripper emporium and to ask to be escorted to the basement, making note of a pair of clear, lucite heels that would look spectacular on me. Tate is waiting in the basement, her dirty blonde hair slicked back in a fierce ponytail. She's wearing jeans and a wife beater and a leather jacket. And so am I. So are all the girls we've invited. 10 of us who are pretty and fucked up. Girls who keep their ugly beneath the skin where it belongs, even though sometimes it's hard to keep it all in. We all look hot. I say, this room is a wet dream. And everyone laughs nervously, and Tate says, let's rock this shit. She runs up to a thin redhead, a model who's moderately recognizable and lurking near the edge of the room. Tate punches the model in the gut, and I feel tingly all over. And then someone's knuckles connect with my face, and I can taste blood in the back of my throat. I get so angry, I start swinging. I don't care what I hurt. We don't waste any time making any rules or pontificating about the meaning of our Fight Club. We don't do any of that girl-fighting shit. There's no hair-pulling or scratching or screeching helplessly. We're all about closed fists and open-handed face slaps and knees to flat stomachs. We hold throats between our fingers until desperate hands claw at our wrists. We wrestle on the sticky floor and call each other terrible names until the room is sweet with sweat and heavy bruising. We fight until our arms are so heavy and sore we can't lift them. And one girl who's pinned by a large, scary-looking tomboy suddenly shouts, get off of me, you fat ass! Her words are so sharp. We all hear them through the fist falling against flesh and the grunts and the heaving. We all gasp because the tomboy is big-boned, but she's not fat. Tate stops slamming the head of a pixie girl with pink hair against the floor and stares at me across the room. She mouths, I love you. And I smile, even though it hurts. And another set of knuckles connects with my face, ruining the moment. Bitches ruin everything. My jaw feels loose, and some hideous bruises are forming along my cheekbones. I'm pretty sure a couple of ribs are broken. I crawl toward a nearby wall and sit with my knees pulled to my chest. Tate slowly lowers herself next to me. She holds my hands in hers, kisses each of my fingertips, the undersides of my wrists. She says, see, no one can hurt like a girl. We're all slumped in piles of damage. We try to pull ourselves together while contemplating cosmetic strategies for work the next day. I buy the lucite heels and other necessities on the way out, and Tate and I flirt with danger by eating at the chicken shack. We tear greasy fried meat from warm bones with our teeth. Our hands are scraped, but shiny and slick. We smile at each other. This is the most I will ever love another person. When Gus comes over a few nights later, he's holding a chubby baby thigh. He shaved his beard. I tell him if he keeps this up, I might marry him. He says, I can live with that. Gus hands me the baby thigh, dimpled around the knee, and kisses my cheek. I turn and crush my lips against his, even though there isn't an inch of my body that doesn't hurt. We don't bother with wine. We're all teeth and tongue. We tear each other's clothes off, and in my room, he throws me onto the bed. I'm impressed. He's such a quick study.
Gus traces the bruises along my rib cage and all my face, even presses them until I wince. I say, harder. He obeys. I hold up my hand and say, hold that thought, and dial Tate. I hand him the phone. I say, she wants to talk to you. He smiles the sleaziest smile and says, two chicks? That's hot. And I tell him not to talk too much, so we can still fall in love and get married, and he can continue to woo me with fiberglass baby parts. Gus puts Tate on speakerphone, and she tells him all the terrible things she wants him to do to me. I marvel at her creativity and her cruelty, and how much she loves me. Gus does as he's told. He's a good boy. He fucks me like a bad, bad man. And when I come hard, his fingerprints around my throat are still throbbing. I'm barely breathing. I can't find the air. I call out Tate's name until it feels like my throat muscles will unravel. I can taste her in my mouth. The next time I talk to Tate, I will tell her she's the man of my dreams. While Gus sleeps, I hold the baby arm and the baby thigh, so hard and smooth and adorable. I think about how the longer I date Gus, the more baby parts he'll bring me, and maybe eventually we'll have a little family of fiberglass child parts that will never become anything more than what they are. North Country. I have moved to the edge of the world for 2 years. If I'm not careful, I will fall. After my first department meeting, my new colleagues encouraged me to join them on a scenic cruise to meet more locals. The Peninsula Star will travel through the Portage Canal up to Copper Harbor and then out onto Lake Superior. I'm handed a glossy brochure with bright pictures of blue skies and calm lake waters. You'll be able to enjoy the foliage, they tell me, shining with enthusiasm for the Upper Peninsula. Do you know how to swim? They ask. I arm myself with a flask, a warm coat, and a book. At the dock, there's a long line of ruddy Michiganders chatting amiably about when they expect the first snow to fall. It is August. I've just moved to the Upper Peninsula to assume a postdoc at the Michigan Institute of Technology. My colleagues, all civil engineers, wave to me. You came, they shout. They've already started drinking. I take a nip from my flask. I need to catch up. You're going to love this cruise, they say. Are you single? They ask. We sit in a cramped booth drinking Rolling Rocks. Every few minutes, one of my colleagues offers an interesting piece of Upper Peninsula trivia, such as the high number of waterfalls in the area, or the 300 inches of snow the place receives annually. I take a long, hard swallow from my flask. I'm flanked by a balding, overweight tunnel expert on my right, and a dark-skinned hydrologist from India on my left. The hydrologist is lean and quiet, and his knee presses uncomfortably against mine. He tells me he has a wife back in Chennai, but that in Michigan he's leaving his options open. I am the only woman in the department, and as such, I am a double novelty. My new colleagues continue to buy me drinks, and I continue to accept them until my ears are ringing and my cheeks are flushed. Sweat drips down my back. I need some fresh air, I mumble, excusing myself. I make my way slowly to the upper deck, ignoring the stairs and lulls in conversation. Outside, the air is crisp and thin, the upper deck sparsely populated. Near the bow, a young couple make out enthusiastically, loudly. A few feet away from them, a group of teenagers stand in a huddle, snickering. I sit on a red plastic bench and hold my head in my hands. My flask sits comfortably and comfortingly against my ribcage.
I saw you downstairs,
a man with a deep voice says. The sun is setting, casting that strange quality of light, rendering everything white, nearly invisible. I squint and look up slowly at a tall man with shaggy hair hanging over his ears. I nod Are you from Detroit?
I've been asked this question 23 times since moving to the area. In a month, I will stop counting, having reached a 4-digit number. Shortly after that, I will begin telling people I have recently arrived from Africa. They will nod and exhale excitedly and ask about my tribe. I don't know that in this moment, so there is little to comfort me. I shake my head.
Do you talk?
I do, I say.
Are you from Detroit?
He smiles, slow and lazy. He's handsome in his own way. His skin is tanned and weathered, and his eyes are almost as blue-gray as the lake we are cruising on. He sits down. I stare at his fingers, the largest fingers I've ever seen. The sweaty beer bottle in his hand looks miniature.
So where are you from?
I shove my hands into my pockets and slide away from him. Nebraska.
I've never met anyone from Nebraska, he says.
I say, I get that a lot. The boat is now out of the Portage Canal, and we're so far out on the lake, I can't see land. I feel small. The world feels too big. I'd better get back to my colleagues, I say, standing up. As I walk away, he shouts,
My name is Magnus.
I throw a hand in the air, but don't look back. In my lab, things make sense. As a structural engineer, I design concrete mixes, experiment with new aggregates like fly ash and other energy byproducts, artificial particulates, kinds of water that might make concrete not just stronger but unbreakable, permanent, perfect. I teach a section of design of concrete structures and a section of structural dynamics. I have no female students in either class. The boys stare at me, and after class, they linger in the hallways just outside the classroom. They try to flirt. I remind them I will assess their final grades. They make inappropriate comments about extra credit. At night, I sit in my apartment and watch TV and search for faculty positions and other career opportunities closer to the center of the world. There's a pizza restaurant across the street, and above the restaurant, an apartment filled with loud white girls who play loud rap music into the middle of the night and have loud fights with their boyfriends who play basketball for the university. One of the girls has had an abortion, and another isn't speaking to her father, and the third roommate has athletic sex with her boyfriend even when the other two are awake. She has a child, but the child lives with her father. I do not want to know any of these things. Several unopened boxes are sitting in my new apartment. To unpack those boxes means I will stay. To stay means I will be trapped in this desolate place for 2 years, alone. I rented my new home over the phone. It is a former dry cleaner converted into an apartment. There are no windows, save for one in the front door. The apartment, I thought, as I walked from room to room when I moved in, was like a jail cell. I had been sentenced. My new landlady, an octogenarian Italian who ran the dry cleaner for more than 30 years, gasped when she met me.
You didn't sound like a colored girl on the phone, she said.
I get that a lot, I replied. The produce is always rotten at the local grocery store. We're too far north to receive timely food deliveries. I stand before a display of tomatoes, limp, covered in wrinkled skin, some dotted with soft white craters ringed by some kind of black mold. I consider the cost of my dignity if I move in with my parents until I feel a heavy hand on my shoulder. When I spin around, struggling to maintain my balance, I recognize Magnus. I grab his wrist between two fingers and step away. Do you always touch strangers?
We're not strangers.
I make quick work of selecting the least decomposed tomatoes and move on to the lettuce. Magnus follows. I say, We have different understandings of the word stranger. You don't even know my name.
I like the way you talk,
he says. What is that supposed to mean? Magnus reddens.
Exactly what I said. Unless we have different understandings of the words I like the way you and talk.
I bite the inside of my cheek to keep from smiling. I have a weakness for charming men who make witty comebacks.
Can I buy you a drink?
I look at the pathetic tomatoes in my basket, and maybe it's the overwhelming brightness of the fluorescent lighting or the easy listening being piped through the store speakers, but I nod. I say, "My name is Kate." Magnus says,
"Meet me at the Thirsty Fish, Kate."
On the drive there, I stare at my reflection in the rearview mirror and smooth my eyebrows. My groceries sit in a canvas bag on the back seat. It's cold outside, I tell myself. They can wait, and I cannot. At the bar, Magnus entertains me with the silly things girls like to take seriously. He buys me lots of drinks, and I drink them. He flatters me with words about my pretty eyes. He says he can tell I'm smart. I haven't had sex in more than 2 months. I haven't had a real conversation with anyone in more than 2 months. I'm not at my best. In the parking lot, I stand next to my car, holding onto the door, trying to steady myself. Magnus says,
"I can't let you drive home like this."
I mutter something about the altitude affecting my tolerance. He says,
"We're not in the mountains."
He stands so close. The warmth from his chest fills the short distance between us. Magnus takes my keys, and as I reach for them, I fall into him. He lifts my chin with one of his massive fingers, and I say, "Fuck." I kiss him, softly. Our lips barely move, but we don't pull apart. His hand is solid in the small of my back as he presses me against my car. When I wake up, my mouth is thick and sour. I groan and sit up and hit my head against something unfamiliar. I wince. Everything in my head feels loose, lost.
"Be careful. It's a tight fit in here."
I rub my eyes, trying to swallow the panic bubbling at the base of my throat. I clutch at my chest.
"Relax. I didn't know where you lived, so I brought you back to my place."
I take a deep breath. Look around. I'm sitting on a narrow bed. I see Magnus through a narrow doorway standing near a two-burner stove. My feet are bare. A cat jumps into my lap. I scream. Magnus lives in a trailer, and not one of those fancy double-wides on a foundation with a well-kept garden in front, but rather an old rusty trailer that can be attached to a truck and driven away. It is the kind of trailer you see in sad, forgotten places that have surrendered to rust and overgrown weeds and cars on cinder blocks and sagging laundry lines. The trailer on the outside is in a fair amount of disrepair, but the inside is immaculate. Everything has its proper place. I appreciate that.
"You should eat something," he says.
I extricate myself from the cat and walk into the galley area. Magnus invites me to sit at the table, and he sets a plate of dry scrambled eggs and a mug of coffee in front of me. My stomach roils wildly. I wrap my hands around the coffee mug and inhale deeply. I try to make sense of the trajectory between Rotten Tomatoes and this trailer. Magnus slides into the bench across from me. He explains that he lives in this trailer because it's free. It's free because his trailer sits on the corner of a parcel of land. His sister Mira and her husband Jonathan farm. The farm is 20 minutes outside town. There's no cell phone reception. "I can't check my email," he tells me, as I wave my phone in different directions, desperate for a signal. I ask him why he lives this way. He says he has a room in his sister's house he rarely uses. He likes his privacy, he says. "You took my shoes off." Magnus nods.
"You have nice feet."
"Can you Take me to my car. Magnus sighs, quickly pours out the rest of his coffee in the small sink. He is a patient man. I like that, too. On the drive back to town, I sit as far away from Magnus as possible. I try to recreate the events between standing in the parking lot and waking up in a trailer with a cat in my lap. I refuse to ask Magnus to fill in the blanks. At my car, he grips the steering wheel tightly. I thank him for the ride and he hands me my keys. He says,
I'd love your phone number.
I force myself to smile. I say, thank you for not letting me drive last night. I say, I don't normally drink much, but I just moved here. He says,
yes, the altitude.
And waits until I drive away before heading back to his trailer. My father would appreciate the gesture. I remember the pressure of Magnus's lips against mine, their texture, and the smell of his bed sheets. I am in trouble. In my lab, things make sense. The first snow falls in late September. It will continue to fall until May. I tell my mother I may not survive. I tell her this so many times, she starts to worry. I test cement fitness. I fill molds with cylinders of concrete. I experiment with salt water and bottled water and lake water and tap water. I cure and condition specimens. I take detailed notes. I write an article. I turn down 3 dates with 3 separate colleagues. The hydrologist from Chennai reaffirms the openness of his options in the United States. I reaffirm my uninterest in his options or being one of them. I administer an exam that compels my students to call me Battle Axe. I attend a campus social for single faculty members. There are 7 women in attendance and more than 30 men. The hydrologist is there too. He doesn't wear a wedding ring. I'm asked 34 times if I am from Detroit. A new record for a single day. I try to remember where Magnus lives and all I recall is a blurry memory of being drunk, burying my face in his arm as we drove, and him, singing along to the Counting Crows. I love the Counting Crows. There once was a man. There is always some man. We were together for 6 years. He was an engineer, too. Some people called him my dissertation advisor, which he was. When we got involved, he told me he would teach me things and mold me into a great scholar. He said I was the brightest girl he had ever known. Then he contradicted himself. He said we would marry and thought I believed him. A couple of years passed, and he said we would marry when he was promoted to full professor, and then it was when I finished my degree. I got pregnant, and he said we would marry when the baby was born. The baby was stillborn, and he said we would marry when I recovered from the loss. I told him I was as recovered as I was ever going to be. He had no more excuses, and I no longer cared to marry him. While he slept soundly, I spent most of my nights awake, remembering what it felt like to rub my swollen belly and feel my baby kicking. He told me I was cold and distant. He told me I had no reason to mourn a child that never lived. He amused himself with a new lab assistant who consistently wore dressy shoes and short skirts, even though we spent our days working with sand and cement and other dirty things. I found them fucking. The lab assistant bent over a stack of concrete bricks, squealing like a debutante porn star. The man thrusting vigorously, literally fucking the lab assistant right out of her high heels, his fat face red and shiny. He gasped in short, repulsive bursts. The scene was so common, I couldn't even get angry. I'd long stopped feeling anything where he was concerned. I returned to my office, accepted the postdoc position, and never looked back. I would have named our daughter Amelia. She would have been beautiful, despite her father. She would have been 4 months old when I left. Snow has been falling incessantly.